That's Clifford Brown on trumpet opening his own composition, Sandhu, now considered a jazz standard. It's from his 1955 album, Study in Brown. Clifford Brown died in a car accident in Bedford, Pennsylvania, the following year, 1956. He was only 25 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and a program I hope you will find some value in. I think it's going to be exciting. Election 2016 should be the year of the third parties, don't you think? Given the palpable dissatisfaction among voters building over several years with both the Democrats and the Republicans. Yet the duopoly dominates the field of political choice and the political process itself. In this respect, then, it's safe to say that this election cycle, despite all the drama that's going around now, is going to be remarkably like previous elections in that regard. Essentially, a contest between two wings of the same flightless bird, with only token opposition from third parties. Why is this? Why does this continue to happen even now in 2016? Well, we have some help today from Dr. J. David Gillespie, author of Challenges to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics. And I'm delighted that you could join us today.
Thank you, Utrice. It's good to be with you this afternoon.
Thank you so much. Well, actually, this book is the successor to your first book, also on third parties, and you've written quite extensively on third parties, even testifying in policy matters about third parties. So you're on good turf right here. You're very confident in what you're saying. But why is it in 2016, with all the progress that America says that it has made, and we celebrate this every election year, how far we have come and all of that stuff, we're still stuck with a two-party system. How did that come to be?
Well, it's not a good thing, is it? It goes way back in our history. Our framers of the Constitution, as you know, were not very prone toward parties anyway. But as soon as they created their structure, they began to create those political parties. And the structure they created, I don't think they set out to favor a two-party system, but the result of what they created was a two-party system. And you can look at the Electoral College, which rewards third parties very rarely with electoral votes. Mr. Perot, for example, in 1992, got nearly 20% of the popular vote, but no electoral votes. And the Electoral College, you have to have a majority to win, which means that if there were third parties in there actively getting electoral votes, you probably would have selection by Congress. So that's a problem. There is also the problem of single-member district election to Congress and to most state legislatures. That was the kind of representational system that they knew back in the early days of democracy. And contrary to what people think, we're one of the oldest democracies, not one of the youngest democracies, and they didn't know anything about proportional representation. And so they set up this thing where number two might as well not have been in there, and number three running for a single-member district seat will lose for good. And they've added to that over the years gerrymandering, which tends to favor one or the other of the major parties as well. And then most recently, over the last century, what we've done is to add to all of that. We haven't done it, but the policymakers, who are Democrats and Republicans, have, by creating a system in which it is very hard to get on the ballot if you're a new party or an independent challenging the duopoly. State by state, you have to do ballot access. And then one of the real problems, and this is being faced by the Libertarian and the Green, the sort of the leading third parties this time, getting on the debate stage this fall. And I'd like to take a few minutes sometimes while we're talking to talk about the Commission on Presidential Debates. But there are lots of other reasons. The cards are really stacked against third parties coming in from the coal.
Isn't this worthy, though, of a massive legal assault to resolve this question, which is at the base of our so-called democratic process, to say, if in fact we, what is the fear? What is the rationale for maintaining the system for this long, despite the fact that the evidence shows, and you wrote about this also in your previous book, Politics at the Periphery,
right?
That this should now be acceptable because it has been done so successfully for so long, the locking out of other political ideologies and political parties. That itself is a manifestation of an intention to deny democracy to Americans.
Absolutely. It's not so much the travesty that it does to third parties. It's the travesty that it does to voter choice and the ability of the electorate to be in charge of who should be their leaders in this country. It is really, really awful what has taken place. And every time there are third-party challenges, and there are always some, but every time there are some significant ones, and I would say this is a, I don't know that I would agree with you, Utrice, that this is an average year. This may be a little bit above average year for third parties.
There are always court challenges.
And, you know, interestingly enough, third parties often put ideology aside to make a common challenge in federal and state court, for example, debate access or access to the debate stage. The Greens and the Libertarians and even the Constitution Party on the right have been involved this year in a whole bunch of federal and state lawsuits seeking ballot access. And so I applaud them all. I tend to be left of center myself, but, you know, I'm an advocate for third parties in general, precisely for what you're saying. This ought to be a matter of the voter's choice.
Well, in that sense, what, therefore, is the power, or what's within the purview of voters themselves to force a change? If the system clearly doesn't have an interest in changing things, it's working so well for them, they have no particular motivation to change a system that's so carefully organized to assure, you know, their longevity in power. So what tools are available to people who think that, hey, this is time, it's time to turn this thing around and to affirm our rights as well and challenge this notion that forever and a day we should be stuck with essentially a two-party system?
You know, I think, first of all, knowledge is power. And when I grew up, when I was growing up, mom's apple pie and the two-party system were sort of hand in glove, you know, as sacred cows within our society. And people don't feel that way anymore. So already you see in polls that oftentimes majorities say that they would like other parties than the two parties we have to have as choice at election time. So I think the knowledge is beginning to be there. I sometimes rather flippantly say when I'm speaking on third parties that our system may be about twice as good as what the old Soviet one-party system was, you know, because it was engineered. Our political parties in this country are, you know, we oftentimes speak of communist China, you know, as a party regime or a party state. Well, we're a party regime. We're a party state. The two parties have been recognized by the Supreme Court as semi-public institutions of government. That's the official terminology that has been done. There are, besides just having the knowledge that all of that is the case, there are sometimes holes in the fabric of duopoly, and sometimes they come purely for selfish reasons. A Republican state legislator may calculate that a third-party candidate would be good for the Democrats, would be bad for the Democrats. And so a Republican state legislator may focus on a movement to make it easier to have ballot access. And likewise, the Democrats sometime will pursue some kind of easing of requirements on third parties if it benefits the Democrats rather than the Republicans. But there are occasionally some really good people, Democrats and Republicans, who really see how unfair the system is. They ought to be given our support. I would hope very much that your listeners would also look at the Green Party, look at the Libertarian Party, look at other party websites, and find out how to make a contribution, especially during times where these parties are trying to get on state ballots and they're competing with major parties that are already owned and are using their money to reach voters, you know, and have a lot of free time anyway in the media. So I think financially there could be a lot more support given by the voice of the people than we give.
Why don't we have a very loud aversion to the conduct of the duopoly in basically locking out the competition and doing so under the guise that they are legally protected because they're not operating outside of the Constitution? And so they get the advantage of doing really bad things and still hiding under the umbrella of law.
Right. I think there is a lot of sense of hopelessness out there and cynicism. We sometimes think that we have the best political system in the world, and then when you try to question people about that, they will tell you, I don't think anything is changeable in this system. I don't know how. The sense of efficacy that people have is pretty low, and there's just got to be something done to gear people up to this. And what I think I'm doing in my small way is bring that information to people so that they will act upon it. I really do think that people now really have a kind of sense of hopelessness in terms of any kind of major reform in the system. And, that's ironic because third parties have been important because they have been the first to advocate reforms. I wrote an op-ed piece recently pointing out that, yes, this is a milestone year in our history of elections, in that we have the first major party female nominee. But there is a long history of third parties nominating women for the presidency, going back to Victoria Woodall in 1872, 48 years before most women could even vote for president. There was a woman running for president. Great irony. You could be president of the United States if the men would elect you, but you were not eligible to vote during that time. And this long list of people who have run on third-party tickets. In 2008, the Green Party had two nominees, both of them women, for president. That was the year of the 18 million chips in the glass ceiling. But the Green Party had an African-American woman and an Afro-Hispanic woman running for the president. And that was just one of many in a long line of third parties that have done things. Alice Paul founded the National Women's Party, Woman's Party, in the second decade of the 20th century, and that was the militant group that finally brought about the 19th Amendment. They were the people out on the street protesting and in the snows of Washington and that sort of thing. And so third parties have always gotten there first, except they haven't gotten to be elected first. And one reason for that is that when their ideas become popular, they're stolen by the major parties, and the reason to exist tends to die out. So that's another thing third parties have going against them. But emancipation from slavery, there were three third parties that embraced that before the Civil War, you know. And you could go through Social Security, all sorts of things that were first third-party ideas before they were endorsed by the major parties.
As you survey the political landscape now, and we do have several third parties competing, although it is clear that severe damage is being done to them by the system, frustrating their what I would consider a constitutional right to present themselves for consideration and political choice by the voters. But as you survey the landscape, what do you think is happening? What is the role that third parties are serving, and in what way are they impacting this election?
Well, they're in part providing that information. There is a, you know, I think the internet and all that's happened in our digital era has been beneficial for third parties, because websites, 24/7 cable. I think CNN should be applauded this year for what it has done. Nothing like leveling the playing field, but they have CNN and of course C-SPAN as well have brought third parties into people's homes in a way that perhaps they have not been before. And so I think third parties themselves are sort of picking up the baton, and they are insisting. There is so much that's being written now about the awful rule that the Commission on Presidential Debates uses for access to the debate stage. I don't know whether you know the history of that or not, but if you have...
Oh, yeah, we've talked about it, the League of Women Voters.
The League of Women Voters, they were great when they were running it, and they gave it up in 1988 because they said that the debates were becoming stage-managed charades by the major parties. And in October 1988, they gave it up, and they were replaced by this bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. It is a nonprofit under our law. It is, you read the Wikipedia article, it says, it is always controlled by the Democratic and Republican parties. Its heads are always former top leaders of the DNC and the RNC. And they require that you have all the qualifications that the Constitution requires for being president. No problem with that. They require that you be on a ballot, the ballots of states with an accumulated total of 270 electoral votes. I don't have much problem with that, except it's very difficult for third parties to meet that requirement. But the third is the catch-22, and it is that you be at 15% of the vote in five consecutive most recent surveys. And they even named this year, they are ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, and NBC. And some of those run with newspapers as well. But you have to be at least at 15%. And until this year, none of those polls even listed third-party candidates. So to be at 15% meant that 15% of the respondents indicated none of the names you've given me are who I'm going to vote for. I'm going to vote for so-and-so, you know, a third-party candidate. At least this year, the Commission on Presidential Debates had the decency to say, to request of these polling agencies, why don't you put Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, the two leading third-party candidates this year, on your survey list so that people will have an opportunity to choose them. And Gary Johnson is reaching up 10 to 12%. Jill Stein is behind that, but is coming up. But I think it's very doubtful that by the first debate in September, they will be at 15%. And that is just mind-bending to think that is a requirement set for access to that state. You know, the implication is that people cannot understand more than two people debating. And when you think back on how many Republicans this year were running during the primaries, the early primaries.
17.
And so much that they had a two-stage process each time, if you'll remember, you know. And
correct. Yes.
Go back to 2008, it was almost that way with the Democrats. So we have long become accustomed to things called debates that had a lot more than two people in them, but just not in the fall when it comes down to competition between more than two parties.
How can the electorate force the hand of those in control of these processes, legally just challenge them, in order to assure that Americans have freedom, true freedom of choice?
Well, I would recommend there are a lot of these things like MoveOn.org and so forth that have little things where you can sign your name to a petition. If any of your listeners come across those sorts of things, I would recommend that they do that. For one thing, you probably will your name will be put on a list, a good list, to help in other ways with making the challenge to the duopoly. So I think that's one thing that can be done. I think that the more that people think about throwing your vote away is always voting for the lesser of two evils. As they begin to think about that, I think they can punish the two parties for this joint duopoly. You know, the Democrats and Republicans don't agree. They agree with more on policy than meets the eye, but they like to do a lot of public fighting. But they are of one mind when it comes to preserving this duopoly. And I would hope that a lot of people this time, even if Gary Johnson or Jill Stein or one of the many socialists or right-wingers, whatever the voters' preference is, even if they know that those people are not going to win the presidency, I would like to think that a lot of people will punish the major parties by staying away entirely or by going and voting their conscience.
Was there a time that such a tactic ever worked in political history?
There have been times where, there have been times at state level, for example. You know, one of the most interesting examples of a third party was the Reform Party in Minnesota, now called the Independence Party of Minnesota. That was the party that nominated Jesse Ventura for the governorship. And, you know, a lot of people think of his feather boa and his wrestling career and all of that. But there were people who went to Jesse Ventura because he represented an alternative. And Minnesota unusually had requirements that were relatively easy for a third party. Not easy, but relatively easy. For example, it had same-day registration. And that year, they calculated that huge record numbers registered to vote on the day they went to vote. These were new outsiders coming in, and that overwhelmingly they voted not Democrat or Republican, but for Jesse Ventura. Another rule in the state of Minnesota was that fulfilling some reasonable requirement would put a third-party candidate on the debate stage. And Jesse Ventura came without coat and tie, came in a turtleneck sweater, not his feather boa, they say, but came and said, my two opponents have their kids in private schools. I am a regular guy. My kids go to public schools. And there he was looking out over an audience in the state of people, the males of which generally don't wear a coat and tie when they go to work. There was Jesse Ventura dressed like they were and talking the language that they understood. And I think that one thing that could be insisted upon is that those kinds of rules, debate access, same-day registration, those are the kinds of things that can be worked on without it seeming to be necessarily challenging, the prominent place of the Democratic and Republican parties. And so I would hope that people would work at that level. You know, there have been cases in our history where even at the national level, third parties have been important. 1912 was a year in which the Bull Moose Progressives, that was, by the way, the first party that ever used a woman as an elector, a president. That was 8 years before women got the right to vote nationally, but there was a Progressive Party elector who from California who actually cast one of the electoral votes that the Progressives got that year. And Teddy Roosevelt came in second in that, and the socialist Eugene V. Debs got 6% that year. And so people ought not to despair. You know, if there is a will that generates and develops, it can happen someday, I think.
Well, that's a good place to leave the discussion for today. I want to thank you so much, Professor Gillespie. Actually, you're retired now, but you're still a professor. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope we can count on you coming back soon to finish up, because this is very important to understand in this year of third parties. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I would like very much to do that. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Well, a party delegate, super delegate vote, not the regular popular vote, decided who the duopoly's presidential nominees would be. As you recall, come November, the United States Electoral College, not voters directly, officially will decide on who the president and vice president of the United States will be. Dr. David Brady, the Bowen H. and Janice Arthur McCoy Professor of Political Science in the Stanford Graduate School of Business, long title, discusses with us today the historic role of the Electoral College and its role in the political process and whether it's an impediment to democracy. Thanks for being with us today, Professor Brady.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start right there. How is it that people don't generally know that their votes, their direct votes, are not electing the president and vice president of the United States in much the same way that their votes directly did not lead to electing the nominees, the presidential nominees of Democratic and Republican parties?
Well, at the Constitutional Convention, the founders had read a great deal of Roman history, and particularly at the end when the Republic failed, the battles between Marius and Sulla. So when they gathered in Philadelphia, they were worried about two kinds of tyranny. The one kind of tyranny was a majority tyranny, where a majority of people tyrannized a minority. And the second was a minority tyrannizing over a majority. And when they created the House of Representatives, a directly elected majoritarian body, they thought they had solved the problem of minority tyranny over a majority because the House was directly elected. Therefore, at the convention, they spent most of their time worrying about minority, about the how to prevent majority tyranny. So there were two reasons to create the Electoral College. The first was they didn't want the Electoral College manipulated by demagogues, etc. And so the idea was to create extra barrier between the people and who would be elected president. Therefore, the people didn't directly vote for president. They voted for the electors, who then chose the president. That's one reason. And the second reason is that there was a compromise between the big states and the small states and the South and the North, where the South was a slave economy and the North was a more commercial economy. And so the compromises put together were ones which put barriers between, other than the House of Representatives, that's why the Senate was elected by state legislatures, that's why there's separation of powers, president's powers outline. The idea was to prevent a tyranny, and the tyranny they were worried about is a majority tyrannizing over a minority, and so they created the Electoral College so that the best people would select the president.
Well, that's one great explanation. The other explanation is that they essentially are having a discussion among themselves. They are not disagreeing that they are all entitled to make decisions for the rest of the country, and that the ordinary people were just not smart enough to make sensible political choices, so they didn't trust them.
Well, they partially trusted them to elect the members of the House. They didn't fully trust them, that's correct, but it was 1787 and not 17. It was the 18th century and not the 20th century. So I think one of the worst things to do is to go back and try and take our positions, where they were clearly wrong. But the question is, you know, if we put ourselves in that position in the 18th century, it's not clear to me what we would have done, given the circumstances at the time.
But simply, I mean, time has passed, and people have learned a couple of things along the way. And one of the things one presumes that they've learned is that it's time to change the system because it's not especially democratic. And maybe we should just go with a system that whoever gets the most votes wins, and leave it at that. What's wrong with that idea, that approach?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. Many, many countries have it. The problem is that once you have a constitution that says this is the way we're going to do things, and we have changed, the electors no longer, the last elector, I believe, who voted independently of the way the state voted was a Alabama elector for John Kennedy, and there may have been one or two others, but today electors are chosen by the parties and the candidates, and so the Electoral College does not overturn how the state voted. So there, it has democratized in that fashion. But once the Electoral College is in place, then interests are established. So There have been bills in the 50s under President Eisenhower. There were two attempts to change the Electoral College. Montcudier was one. Both were bipartisan, Democrat and Republicans. One Democrat and a Republican sponsored it. And the reason it got turned down was because the Electoral College benefits the small states. So Wyoming gets three votes, right? Each state gets the number of representatives that it has, so two senators and a House member. So Wyoming cast 210,000 votes in the last election, and that means each person, each electorate of the three was 70,000 votes, where in California, at 54 electors, members of the Electoral College, average was about 190,000. So the small states wouldn't want to repeal it because they're advantaged by it. And the big competitive states that get all the attention, they wouldn't want to do it either because they get extra attention because they're so big. So both times that these things were proposed, a combination of big states and small states beat them down.
Well, let's talk about the logistics of how this Electoral College works. Is
sure.
What's 500 and I think it's 38 people? 538 people, including 435 members of Congress, 100 senators, plus three additional electors from the District of Columbia. These are the people. So when people go to vote on Election Day in November, they're thinking they're casting their vote for candidate A or candidate B, either Republican or Democratic Party or any other party. But in fact, they are electing the electors who will then decide who is going to be the final winner. Is that how it works now?
That's exactly how it works. So then the members of the Electoral College then either go to Washington on a particular day and cast their ballots, and you get the winner. But technically, you are not voting, even though the ballot says your vote for Hillary Clinton. In California, you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton or the Libertarian candidate or the Green candidate or Donald Trump. And what you're actually voting for is 54 members. Each of those candidates has 54 people designated as electors, who then will cast the ballot for the state for the winner.
Now, are they bound by any rules to basically, if they get elected, how do they determine? Let me ask the question this way: are they able to just make up their own minds as to who they want? Irrespective of what the voters said that they want?
Yeah, technically they could do so, but remember, Mrs. Clinton chooses the 50. Mrs. Clinton and the Democratic Party in California, say, where I'm from, they choose the 54 electors, so they are not going to. So they're not going to violate that because they're selected by the candidates. Technically they could, but they don't.
Does this sound like democracy to you?
Well, it sounds like a peculiar American variant of democracy. Yeah. Sorry, but I mean it's a little peculiar, but
it's plenty peculiar. I imagine if you're having, especially if you're broadcasting to the world, you're practically the seat of Western democracy. And you have, first, you have the primary elections, which, of course, is another set of the same thing. People thinking they are electing a candidate when they actually are electing the electors who will elect the candidate. And then they go on to the next level thinking the same thing. Well, I'm voting for Jill Stein, or I'm voting for Joe Doakes. Then they find out, well, really, my vote is not directly going to elect Jill Stein or Joe Doakes, but it is going to elect the elector. So this does not sound at all democratic to me, and I don't understand why this thing has not yet been challenged successfully in a court of law. And we should have, despite all the rationales given, I keep in mind that the rationales were laid out by the people who designed the system, and they thought it was good, so naturally they will defend it. But I'm concerned about this, the very definition of democracy and the practice of it. And from the point of view of what is the voter entitled to in terms of a constitutional right?
Well, that's a good question. I must say, of the two, the Electoral College versus the primary system, I'm a lot more worried about the primary system than I am about the Electoral College. I think the primary system, if you actually look at it this year, 9% of the total American electorate chose Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. So the prospects of demagoguery in the primary, I think, is greater because turnout is low and it varies state by state. The Electoral College, in general, works. So I would, above the two, I'm like you, I'm more worried about, of the two, I'm more worried about the primary than the other. But your question about legal cases, so, you know, I don't I don't know. It's the only cases I know where the Constitution has been sued are cases, cases in regard to voting rights in states where you have state senates that were quite malapportioned, where very few voters elected one senator and House members were not. So you had a series of cases in the 60s that changed all that so that state legislatures cannot malapportion. So you can't have a district in the rural part of California where you got 170,000 people elect one senator and L.A. elects one senator. So that was Westbury versus Sanders. There's a whole series of cases. So the Constitution in the states was challenged. But, you know, it was and in the House of Representatives, the districts had to be made of equal size. But the Senate never came up. Where in the Senate, of course, there's much more inequality there because about 30 million people in California have two senators and 400,000 people in Wyoming have two senators. So I know that the only cases I know the Supreme Court has chosen not to hear cases regarding the Senate and malapportionment. So I there may be cases that I don't know about. But I know that none of them have gotten to the Supreme Court in regard to the issue that you brought about. And politically, it's hard to change the Constitution, obviously, because you have to get three quarters of the states, et cetera. So that has there are no cases that I know of that made it to the Supreme Court. And I think the Supreme Court would be highly wary of wanting to look at things like changing the Senate to make it like the states in regard to malapportionment, or changing the Electoral College by a court decree. So I share with you the fact that it's surprising that they haven't gotten that far, but I think the court is sort of wary of those issues.
But
there may be callers and other people that know more about the court cases than I do.
But that doesn't do anything really to change the fact that our political system, to borrow Donald Trump's term, is rigged. And it has been rigged for a long time. In terms of, we just finished talking with Professor David Gillespie, and we talked about third parties and their role in expanding this concept of democracy and influencing change in a democratic way. However, he was also careful to note that the deck is stacked against third parties. So it stands to reason that even in this issue of how electors are apportioned, you will find the same contradictions there, which means that the voting power of the average voters is again being usurped. And there seems to be nothing they can do about it. They just have to stick with the system because, well, gee, it was put in place by very smart people, and therefore you just have to live with it. But the argument could be made, for example, you talked about apportionment. Let's say a district, the district that Shirley Chisholm ran from, ran in the 5th Congressional District in Brooklyn, it used to be once upon a time a contiguous congressional
yes.
district. But the powers that be, the Democratic powers that be, carved it up into five separate congressional districts, specifically to dilute the voting strength of African Americans in that district. And that was just a sample of what was repeated all around the country. So when we exclude these factors, we can, you know, we can deal with these things in an almost arithmetic way, but we will be doing so excluding some very important factors that are linked to the exercise of democratic rights. And this is a very serious question. So I'm wondering, when will it, from your perspective, what would it take for the United States to progress to the point where it could trust the people to make sensible decisions, their own choices, in a popular vote that elects a president, as opposed to this crazy arithmetic formula that they have?
Well, I don't expect it Anytime. So what? There's. So let me begin. There is one reform that has made a little progress. So there is nothing in the Constitution of the United States that says that the person with the most votes in the state gets the entire electoral college vote. So, in other words, if there were four candidates and one won 26%, two 25%, and one won 24%, all 54 of California's votes would go to the candidate with the 26%. Now, that's not constitutionally mandated. So two states, Maine and Nebraska, have changed that. And instead of a winner-take-all, it's winner-take-all by congressional district. So Nebraska can split its Nebraska can and has had a split vote in a presidential in the Electoral College, and Maine can do the same. So there's a possibility that states can change that way and do it by congressional districts. But again, that seems to me not in line with what you suggested earlier. It's like the primary system where, you know, the votes of the Republican and the Democratic things were apportioned by who won what district, and it took you days to actually figure out who'd won the most delegates to the convention. So that's the same problem. I don't foresee anything coming quickly. I think it would, if this election were very close and things got thrown into the House, or like the 2000 election, when you get an election like that, then there's a lot of pressure generated to change the system. So I think it would take a very close election, and when you had that sort of situation, then that would generate pressure to change the system. But in lieu of that, I think what happens is what you suggested earlier. Politicians just accept the system for what it is, and they go out and play the game, and they play the game to win, and they're not really trying to change the structure of the system.
But with the Electoral College, we have had instances where a president has won the popular vote but did not win the electoral vote.
Absolutely.
So how is this a fair system that would work exactly the same way every time?
Well, it wasn't. There's no question. There's no question that the 2000 electoral result, Al Gore won the popular vote and lost the Electoral College vote. So there's no way to guarantee that will not happen again. And I think if it happens again, that's the time that you'll get more pressure to change the system. But as you know, it takes a great deal of time to change the system. One example of that, when I lived in Houston, when I was at Rice University, the white versus registered, the Houston City Council had 9 members, 1 African-American, and the system was set up so that even though there were 9 districts, the vote was counted citywide. And so we went to court, and in the court case, we got rid of the at-large voting because we argued it was discriminatory against African-Americans. And former Congressman Mickey Leland and Barbara Jordan were with us when we were doing this. And it changed. And as soon as it changed, we immediately had 3 African-Americans and a Latino representative. And as you know, since that time, Houston's had a couple of black mayors. It's had the first lesbian mayor. So there's progress to be made. But it seems to me most of the time the progress is sort of at the state and local level, which is easier to change than the federal level. But it's very slow. You're absolutely right on that. Slow.
Slow, but deliberate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
okay, really slow.
Do you think there would ever be a convincing case that, A, most Americans really do not understand this process at all, and if they understood it, they would probably not like it, and they would probably like something else that is simpler to understand and easier to manage and more in line with their concept of what democracy is, which is, if I vote for Joe Dokes and he gets the most votes, he should win. Plain and simple.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's correct. The problem in a problem in a country, a big, diverse country like the United States, is getting enough people to focus on that issue over a sufficient time period to change things. And what happens is that I think people who are for that are more concerned about a set of issues regarding the economy, et cetera. There's only so many things you can do, and when you prioritize them, I think the reforms you're talking about get pushed down and therefore don't get dealt with because there's other matters that are higher on the priority list.
Well, it's funny because I don't see this as a reform at all. I think this is a system organized against the democratic rights, the small d, the democratic rights of individuals, because that is the system that assures that things will produce predictable results. And there's a certain level of comfort the power elite derives from knowing that they're in control of things. No matter how bad, like the oil business, even if it's bad, it's good. They still are in control.
Well, Professor, I can say that in the 2016 election, I assure you the Republican Party does not favor the Electoral College because the Electoral College has about a 30 to 40 seat disadvantage to Republicans. And Donald Trump. And so in this case, my view is I'm actually happy that this is correct. At least if you're going to change it after 2016.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Brady, for being with us today.
Sure. Thank
very,
you.
Very, very scintillating. And I hope we can call on you again very soon to untangle
Thanks.
This mysterious entity called the Electoral College.
Thanks.
Thanks. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope we learned something about third parties and the Electoral College. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. And tomorrow, it's Free Your Mind Friday. Get your brains in gear.